So here we are on day two of the IBM convention on the showroom floor. When I say showroom floor, we're right in the very middle, actually, of the convention activities in the dealer's room over here. And last night we were treated to a showing of Desperate Acts of Magic, and I am fortunate to have real live stars of the feature film and directors, Joe Gold and Tammy Kaplan. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm so excited to have you guys here and excited to see the movie. I've seen the trailer and knowing all the promo and everything, got a great website and everything, but I thought it was just a great movie.
Oh, thank you.
I hope more and more people do it. Now, was this your first venture as an independent filmmaker?
This is our second feature film. My first one is a film about Shakespeare called Never Say Macbeth.
Yeah, it's about actors who put on Macbeth and all kinds of crazy things go awry and ghosts start appearing. Yeah. It has a little bit of magic, not a lot, but Tony Clark actually helped us with some magic on that movie. Mm-hmm. We didn't direct that one. We produced it and we were both in it. This one was Desperate Acts of Magic is the first one that we actually directed.
And we also edited the movie and produced it.
Yeah,
it kind of reminds me of my mind just went blank. The guy who had done Spy Kids and Robert Rodriguez.
Rodriguez.
You know, where he had his family and friends, and they all they acted, they edited.
Yeah, El Mariachi.
Yeah, El Mariachi, exactly.
This really was like a labor of love. I mean, Joe really recruited a lot of people that he knew from back from Magic Camp. Jonathan Levitt is in our movie. He met Joe when they were, 13?
You know, 15, 14.
Yeah. Magic Camp.
Yeah, exactly. And, we shot it really slowly. We shot it just a day or two a month for, 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is pretty intense. So you had a lot of time, obviously, to prepare for that. As I recall, you said you were storyboarding, and you two of you kind of walked through the scenes.
Yeah, what we would do is we would do these video storyboards where we would take just a little cheap camcorder and we'd film the scene, and Joe and I would play all the parts, and then we'd edit it, and then we'd see whether or not the scene was working, and from that we would create our shot list. Okay, we need a close-up here, we need a medium shot here, a wide of this, and just helped us get more prepared for the filming.
Go ahead.
Also with the magic, so many of the scenes had magic. Frequently we're working out, exactly what effect will we be doing, how will we be accomplishing it, and we would be interacting with our magic consultants. Tony Clark and David Regal would help us. We'd make a little video, send it to them, they'd send us back feedback. And we'd work, going slowly allowed us to take that time.
Another advantage of going slowly and taking time is that we were able to work around the different magician schedules. Because, magicians, they work a lot, they have crazy schedules,
odd hours.
Many of them, especially in Los Angeles, are also actors, they get auditions. And so this way we were able to get the cast that we really wanted.
And so these were friends of yours, obviously, and kind of doing you favors and helping out
Them, yeah. I mean, although we also cast several people that we didn't know that just came in and auditioned for us, and we cast. And, it was it's a SAG ultra-low-budget film, so everyone's working for nothing or next to nothing.
Yeah.
And
SAG minimum.
Yeah. And next to nothing adds up for us.
Sure. We said it was, about a $60,000 film or something?
Yeah, for the film itself, not marketing or distribution, but the film itself, about $60,000.
So you're trying to get, a distributor?
Well, we have a VOD distributor.
Okay.
And so the VOD distributor will bring it to your cable VOD and iTunes, Netflix, that kind of thing.
Right.
And then we'll also be selling DVDs through our website.
We're selling DVDs right now at IBM, and later on we'll be selling DVDs off our website so that everybody across the country can, or across the nation, can, across the world can get
right.
it.
Yeah.
And so they're available that way, but then you can also get them, you were saying last night, if you want to have them come and show in your local theater? Talk about that a little bit. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, so there's it. We're working with a company called Tug. It's T-U-G-G. And it's tug.com. And it allows people to request the movie at their local movie theater.
Yeah.
So you say, hey, I'd like to see Desperate Acts of Magic in my hometown. Here's a local theater that I like to go to. Here's the date that I'd like to see it. And they usually do a weeknight. And then they'll say, okay, you can do that. It's no charge. But you have to get 75 people or 80 people to RSVP and buy tickets ahead of time.
At least a week in advance.
A week in advance. And the Dallas Magic Club did this, and it was a very big success. Mm-hmm. Some of the other cities have had trouble getting that many people to RSVP ahead mm-hmm. of time.
And I think people aren't used to buying tickets ahead of time for a movie.
That's true. You know, Fandango is one that's, yeah, I don't know how successful they are, but those kinds of things, I know what you mean.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you have a small magic club, 20 people, and you don't think that you guys can get together 75 people on a Tuesday night, we'll work with you, and we could do a smaller screening at your local magic club. If you have a way to show a DVD or a Blu-ray, mm-hmm. you know, we'll work it out so you can have a screening, and we'll do a Skype video Q&A.
Yeah, you mentioned that you did that with Dallas. That sounded like a pretty cool
thing. Yeah, yeah.
Now, when did this actually go in the can? When was it wrapped?
Oh, well,
we
finished it in, well, we okay, we finished editing in May of 2012, mm-hmm. where it was completely done, and that's when we submitted to a few of the bigger film festivals, Toronto and Sundance, because you have to, just in case, yep. you know, the big ones want you. But, you know, the film festivals, they really do like the name actors and the serious issues, and not so much the fun movies like this as much,
right.
you know. But then, while we were promoting the movie, we were contacted by, I think I could say his name, yeah, we got contacted by Lee Aronson. Now, Lee is not a name that you know, but you know his work. He's the co-creator of 2.5 Men.
Oh, okay.
And a showrunner from Big Bang Theory.
Okay.
So he's written all these episodes of 2.5 Men and Big Bang Theory, very successful television producer. He saw our trailer. It's so funny. He saw our trailer on Sean McMaster's magazine.
Oh, okay.
Mandala.
The Mandala.
I saw that was in the
yeah.
movie too.
Yeah. So Lee happened to see the Mandala website and saw our trailer, and he contacted us. He said, "Love your film. Love to get involved." And we were like, yeah,
wow,
sure.
Yeah. What a name.
And so we met with him, and he gave us all these notes. He said, love the movie, but I have notes that I'd like you to take.
Film is already locked. And what it means, when a film is locked, it's very expensive to unlock it.
You can't go back in and re-edit
it. It's harder.
And expensive.
But Lee was offering to put a little money into distribution.
Behind, like Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, enough that it made it worth our while. You know, and so... So we made all kinds of tweaks. We cut about 3 minutes out of the movie, and we actually added an insert. This is just, I forget when we did this, but early 2013.
February 2013, we put in an
insert at the beginning of the movie. There's a shot of me performing on a Vegas stage when I do the vanishing bottle trick at the very beginning of the movie.
I remember that, yes. Right.
Yes. So that wasn't in there.
Oh.
And Lee asked us to put that in there.
He didn't specify the vanishing bottle, of course. Well, he's going to have like a montage.
He wanted to see my character's dream right up front.
Ah, that makes sense.
To know
sure.
what am I going for.
Yeah.
And it was a great note, and so we took it, and so we finally, I guess, officially finished shooting this past February.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy because we knew, when we met Lee, we knew we were going to be in New York, that we were going to be opening in New York in May. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, we're opening up our movie and we don't have it ready. And there's all this marketing stuff that you're supposed to do and things to get ready. And it was a crazy time.
Yeah, it was chaos.
But
it worked.
It
worked out. It's a better movie for it. Moves along at a good pace. It's only 86 minutes. I mean, you saw it.
Yeah.
It moves fast.
It did. I thought it was only an hour. I thought, wow, where'd the time go? Yeah, exactly. Well, it was full length, yeah.
And then we brought it to New York. We played at the Quad Cinema, which
Greenwich Village.
We played for supposed to be just a week, But it went very well, and they extended us for, so we played 2 weeks in Greenwich Village.
And we played a week in Los Angeles at the Lemley NoHo 7.
And it was good.
And I saw that on the trailer, it showed that you had some sort of, like Toronto Film Festival or some other awards that had received, is that right?
Well, we've been getting some very good reviews.
Maybe that was what it was.
Submitted it really for festivals all that much, because one of the reasons we didn't submit it to a lot of festivals is because we really wanted to come in between Burt Wonderstone and Now You See Me.
Mm-hmm. So, in fact... Well, Magic Riding on a High.
Exactly. Yeah, and because we're the small film, they're such big films.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and we wanted to kind of leverage their marketing budget.
Yeah.
And it worked,
like,
you know.
It's like putting your restaurant right next to, you got a fast food place between Burger King and McDonald's.
Exactly.
Yeah, people are going there already.
Exactly. It worked because, you know, some of the press talked about it more. The Wall Street Journal did a big story on magic in the movies, and they covered us. And so, but we got great reviews. You know, the New York Times really liked us, the Village Voice, Variety. So we've had some great reviews, some good attention. It's been nice.
So what are you ultimately hoping to get out of it? Obviously not a lot of cash, but maybe some notoriety or enough cash to do another film?
Yeah, it'd be great to have the respect of the industry enough and maybe access to some money that we could make it our next film, of course.
You know, we think this is a movie that magicians can really feel proud about, that they can really, I think it really puts magic in a good light.
Right.
And it shows how you can take magic and really incorporate it into a story. Just like with a musical, you know, the songs either tell us something about the character or move the story along. That was our goal with the magic, to sort of, you know, be able to tell a story using illusions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're hoping that the magic community really embraces the movie and feels good about it.
Right. Well, that's true, because most times they depict a magician as being a villain or some geek or an insane person or whatever. And these are just regular guys. You know, I think it did show some interesting characteristics, I guess, or sides of personalities. I thought, you know, like Jonathan Levitt's character was kind of cool. You know, like he was super cool guy and good with the girls and everything.
Yeah,
and then it's like, wait a minute, all of a sudden that you became the master, you know? So you'd mentioned in the movie also that you just mentioned you had gone to Magic Camp and you knew Jonathan nothing back then. Did you win then, really, Magic Camp? He got fourth?
I mean, that is true. That is true. Back, when I was maybe 15 or 16, I did an act with a teddy bear, and I did get first place that year, and Jonathan got fourth. And then here we are 25 years later, and he's a very successful magician, and I'm still pounding the pavement.
There's a ton of stuff from the movie that really is from Joe's life. I mean, he really it's a really personal movie for Joe. I mean,
I mean, well, quite a bit is, you know, I said in the Q&A last night that I really did compete at the 1998 IBM convention in Los Angeles, and I don't want to give a plot away for people who haven't seen the movie, but the events that transpired at that convention are depicted in the movie quite a bit.
So, you know, Joe really wanted to do something that was very personal, and I asked him, I said, you know, pick something from your life. This is sort of based on acting exercise that both of us have learned. You know, pick something from your life that you could act out that nobody else in the world could act out as well as you, because it's very meaningful to you. And he picked, from his adult life, he picked what happened at the 1998 IBM convention, and it's like, that's what you got to write about.
Yeah, and it just happened that was in, like, February of 2010, and I saw that the IBM convention in 2010 was happening in San Diego, which was in striking distance of where we live in Los Angeles. I said, so if I write this movie fast enough, we can shoot almost, you know, as much as possible at the IBM convention in San Diego and get locations and extras and production values for free.
Right.
When we contacted IBM, they didn't want us to shoot actual convention activities.
Mm-hmm. They had a documentary that came there the year before, and I guess it didn't go so well.
Show them in the best light.
Yeah. Well, no, not that it didn't show them in the best light, but it was disruptive. It was a lot of disruptive.
Oh,
yeah. And so they said, well, as long as you really keep out of the way and don't shoot any convention activities, you can be here a little bit. And so we just shot a day. a day at that convention. Were you there?
I was not in San Diego. I missed that year.
Okay. Yeah, so we just shot one day, and then now we had a day in the can. Now we had to recreate the convention outside of the convention. Mm-hmm. You know, so the first thing we did was we said, oh, well, you know, these lanyards, how do we reproduce these lanyards?
Yeah.
Surely we can make these lanyards and make them match close enough. They're so expensive. I don't know how the IBM does it, but it's like, these are expensive.
Yeah.
So after, you know,
every little thing, I was thinking about the banners. You even had to said, you know,
well, the banners were not hard. The banners were actually
cheaper?
Pretty easy. Yeah.
I thought that was a big expense. So
yeah,
I saw
it
that.
Wasn't that expensive, and that's why it said BM as opposed to
right.
IBM.
Right.
And but so we contacted IBM and they let us buy their old lanyards.
That was really nice of them.
So we got a lot of them.
We didn't tell them beforehand that we
what
were saying
do?
Calling it the BM convention.
Well, no, actually, you know, Terry Richardson suggested that I change it because he didn't want us
that's
to
true.
Use their logo.
Not being infringement or anything.
Yeah, and so we made it BM. And
where did they actually film that? It looked like it was almost this small house. Or
yeah, most of the convention activities were shot at it's the Redondo Beach Castle, which is a small castle, a large house where Brian Gillis lives in Sisupan.
Was that on Homes of the Magicians? I think it had Matt King, Lance Burton's home, and I think it showed.
I wouldn't be surprised. It's a very cool place.
Yeah. Giant magic posters from the floor to the ceiling. Beautiful place. It almost looks like a little bed and breakfast. I'm surprised they don't turn it into a bed and breakfast.
Yeah, so we shot for 3 days there, and it was very nice of them to let us do that.
And we called it the Magician
Inn.
Yeah.
Very clever, very clever. Well, where do you go from here? I want to kind of wrap this up. But what's your next...
Sure. Well, you know, we're doing these screenings around the country. If you want to bring the movie to either your local movie theater or your local magic club, you know, just go to DesperateActsOfMagic.com and you can contact us and make that happen.
Become a fan on Facebook and then you'll know, you know, when...
Shown.
Yeah, where it's going to be shown. And also, you know, once we've got the DVD released here at IBM, but then eventually in like late summer, fall, we're going to release the DVD nationwide.
Yeah.
And then you'll be able to keep track of when that's happening.
Well, that's kind of a neat release. And but for people who are at the convention now, you got a special deal with the poster and everything, I guess.
You buy the DVD, it's $20, and it comes with a free poster.
Well, that's a great deal. You
pay
$20 for a poster. You know, and you get the DVD for free. Kind of look at it that way.
Exactly. And the DVD has lots of special features, got behind the scenes.
Is that Blu-ray?
No, it's just a straight DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's got commentary. It's got some nice extras on it.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, so people who are listening to this podcast then who are thinking about coming to the convention and you're within a short distance within Phoenix, you need to be sure to come because there's still a lot of activities yet to come because these podcasts get updated and posted every day. So,
cool.
You know, there are people, this will be on tomorrow morning.
Oh,
and
great.
Wonderful.
We thank you guys very much. And look, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And so my question that I always ask my guests is, what is your magic word?
Oh.
It wouldn't be necessarily like presto change or whatever.
No, unga bunga bunga. That is the magic word that I did at all my kid shows. It was unga bunga bunga. Do you have a magic word, Tammy?
About simsalabim.
Well, that's
just something. It could be your mantra. Something it could be a goal. You know, something that is your slogan. Your life. Your chi.
Well,
you know, what is it?
I would say Tammy and I. It's just constant persistence. You know, mm-hmm. following. You know, just keep going at it, and you know, sticking with it. You know. When I did this, the act that appears in the movie back in '98, you know, I finally get to show it to the world with this movie. And so, you know, it took a long time, but, you know, persistence.
Persistence. That's a good magic word
there.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was Joe Gold and Tammy Kaplan. And from the floor of the IBM dealer's room here in Phoenix, Arizona, this is Scotty out. Still here on the showroom floor at the IBM dealer's room, and Michael Dardant walking by. Hey, Michael, how are you?
Doing great.
We're going to try and pick up something that we lost at the TAOM. We had just a fantastic interview, and I have a great chat with a lot of great people, and this is one that I really regret that... This is why I have a new microphone. It's all because of you. You cost me money to buy new equipment. But I wish we could even remember what it was we were talking about. But at that time, you had... I think, had you just won the competition? competition? Probably not.
This was this last 4F.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, it was the Fectors. I'm sorry. Yes. I was thinking of the TAOM, but it was in April over there, yes. And that, but you had, or of course, you by then won the TAOM contest as well as several others. And you tell me about some of your competitions and why you actually got into competition.
It was interesting. I kind of, not maybe the reasons most people do, because I've been around Magic since I was 13. I used to watch all these competitions. And at that time, I had, even though I've always been competitive, like in sports and speech and debate and everything else, mm-hmm. I had no desire to compete at Magic conventions for two reasons. One, I had no interest in trying to impress other magicians or entertain magicians. Mm-hmm. And my focus at that time especially was just, you know, perform for the layman. These aren't the guys you need to impress. And I wasn't trying to come up with any, you know, confusers or for magicians. And the other reason was that I felt that I had nothing original to offer. I wasn't going to enter a competition and just do the standard version of the invisible deck and expect that, you know, just because I'm doing it well, that it's unique enough to win anything. And I actually got tired of seeing acts that had no creativity or originality and were basically just kind of like a copy of things I've seen before, and you know, just because you can, just because you can clone it well doesn't mean that makes you a good performer. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that kind of early on, but then later, having worked in the trenches and being out there doing this, I realized, okay, I have a lot to share now, but the only reason magicians are going to care what I have to say is if I've won awards or been on television. So those were kind of my two goals, was try to do things to get on television, and I'm actively mm-hmm. involved with the film industry and TV in New Orleans and in Louisiana, mm-hmm. and then also to compete. And I figured I'd watched enough of these things that I now know what I needed to do to be original and to define an act that would impress magicians and have something to offer. So, and it's worked out because now I'm able to do some lectures and get booked at conventions and the things that I was never able to do before. So it's opened up a lot of opportunities because of the competition. So
that's awesome.
Last year was a great year because I won pretty much everything I went after. First place at IBM, so that was the big one, and the People's Choice Award, and then...
Did you get the Gold Cups or not?
I did not. No,
that's a tough nut to
crack. Now it's like, I couldn't be done with that, but now I guess I'm going to have to come back up with a new act and come back, because now I really want them. It's weird, because it's like you get addicted to it. Like, ooh, look at that pretty trophy. Ooh, it's pretty trophy probably costs $1, but it's like, I want that on my shelf. It was really exciting, and the response that I've gotten from people has been fantastic, and especially the other performers. That's what's been really cool, is the camaraderie. Like when I was at the PCAM and racked up there and won the Grand Prix, and I finished, I think I was first in one of the competitions, and when I got off, one of the other competitors says something about well, there goes first place. Like, he kind of knew based on my act. He's like, well, you... But he didn't say it in a way of, like, a jealousy way. More of, like, just an inspired way.
Yeah,
of,
sure.
Like, great job. You know, that I know you got it kind of thing. And so...
Wish I could be as good as you. Yeah.
And that's something you don't really see a lot in competitions, you know, especially from other competitors.
More rivalry.
Yeah, you see more rivalry. And mm-hmm. I think because we're involved in an art, that people have a... There's less of that, more of a respect for... Because we all have an admiration of what we're trying to achieve and what it takes to get there.
Right. You know, Jack McBride had said that, a goal is a dream with a deadline.
Right.
And that was something, it sounds like, when I'm hearing your words, that you had a goal of wanting to do something on television. And so the avenue to get there, I guess, was using magic kind of as the medium, I guess.
Pretty much. So, in fact, it was getting involved with speech and debate in high school, specifically because I wanted to be in, like, the theater programs, that led me to meeting a guy 2 years older than me who kind of got me started in magic. And so it was kind of like a means to an end. The fact is, I wanted to be a performer. I never considered myself a magician.
Right.
But being a magician made me more of a unique performer and gave me something to offer that other performers didn't have.
Right. Now, you are performing here and not competing. So are there other conventions where you're working, I guess? You were just talking with Sandra over there about maybe going to compete in the PCAM?
Well, no, I'll be performing in that one.
I
strongly believe, I know some conventions will let you get away with coming back with the same act, but I strongly believe that once you've taken the top prize, it's different. I guess if you still want to get that top prize and your act isn't honed in yet, but once you've got that top prize, I think you got to come back with something different. So I feel like the ones that I've won already, if I want to compete again, I need to work on a new act. But now I'm the new goal is to qualify for FISM. So the only competitions I'm doing this year are the festival in Quebec City, which is going to be an international competition. And it's a four-day festival, so that should be a lot of fun. And then next year, the combined convention, my goal is to qualify to represent North America at FISM. And that was one of those things that it wasn't a goal to begin with, wasn't at all. The goal, I achieved the goal of just getting exposure in the magic community.
Right.
But it's like once you start hitting those goals, you realize you can,
right,
and your vision becomes bigger, and your sense of realism toward it becomes better as well. Like you start to believe, hey, if I won that one, maybe I can win this one. If I'm good enough to do this, maybe I'm good enough to go over here.
Sure.
And now I believe that I can qualify,
right,
which is, if you'd asked me 3 years ago, I'd have been like, that's a pipe dream. Come on, really?
But you gain more confidence all the time. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. You definitely gain more confidence. And now having performed in front of magicians, you gain another level of confidence. So
right,
in addition to this one, I did the performance at Winter Carnival,
yep,
and I'll be performing at PCAM as well, and now actually doing a couple lectures, which is a lot of fun, I think, because for the magician who's doing the lecture, it's kind of like group therapy, because these are the only people you can,
yeah,
talk to about this stuff. You
isn't
really can't share with normal
anybody,
humans.
Yeah.
So I think that's why a lot of guys get into lecturing, is that not just to supplement their income, it's so they can actually have somebody to tell their stories to about what's going on.
Who can appreciate that?
Who can appreciate it?
Yeah, like your creative process and how you got to where you are. And yeah, that's true. Because everyone's trying to, not necessarily emulate someone else, but I think everyone is trying to find their own holy grail, if you will, you know, within
right,
themselves, or at least they should be, you know, trying to find, what can I do for myself, you
right,
know, to be better. And so by listening to other magicians and their lectures and whatnot, I think that you get a better idea of how that person had found their goal.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I have a goal, and what paths should I take? You know, there are a lot of little places you can kind of get sidetracked, certainly, you know,
right,
as long as I guess you have a firm purpose and a goal in mind.
And figuring out what fits you, what's your character, what defines you, and what makes you different than other performers, other magicians.
Do you find that you're the same when you're in performance as you are just when, like right now, just a regular guy? I mean, just in your everyday life, or do you feel like you take on a different persona?
It varies, because I'm involved with so many different types of performing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that my character comes out as long as I want to be entertaining, and in most social settings I want to be entertaining, so
sure,
a lot of people see that similar character in person as on stage. But I also will play certain characters, like I do an act that's completely with a Cajun accent. I call it Cajun Mike.
Yeah.
And so
Cajun Mike,
I call him Cajun Mike. And
okay,
but he's kind of, because you know, everything's with a Cajun accent like that.
Yeah.
Because he's from South Louisiana, because that's where I grew up. And, you know, a lot of people think the Cajun accent's real funny and all, but they don't know that Cajuns, they're real smart, because you know how in schools they teach about double negatives? Cajuns, they master triple, quadruple. It don't matter none, no. That was three in one sense. But so I'm playing kind of a funny, goofy idiot is basically how I describe, you know, Cajun Mike. So
yeah,
obviously I'm not that goofy in real life.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So I'm putting on that persona, the character.
Well, you know, and that was something that I remember Danny Archer was talking on the podcast once about, having another character, because he was inspired by John Carney, you know, by saying that if you have this other character, then you have another show.
Oh,
because
absolutely,
a lot of times if someone hires you, oh, we had that guy last year. Yeah, but if you had Cajun Mike?
Right.
What? Well, I got a whole other character, you know. Or, you know, as Gino Mozzarella, you know, there's a character that Danny Archer would have, which would be different, you know. Or, you know, John Carney. Different, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So I think it's
reinventing yourself and,
yes,
and being versatile. And
yeah,
that's because you become more and more marketable. And that's the thing, like figuring out what makes you versatile as a performer. If you can get booked not just to do magic, but if you can get booked as a juggler, then when you don't have magic shows and it's
right,
a slow week, well, maybe you got a juggling gig.
Right.
So picking up different skill sets and figuring out how to make yourself as adaptable as possible.
It's nice to focus and have something that you're really good at, but I think it's also good to have those additional skills, because a lot of those things can be called on within your core skill set, if you will. Now, you developed a lot of this on the street. You did a lot of street magic. You still do?
I did when I first went to New Orleans.
Okay.
And what's strange is a lot of people see my act and they go, you've got to be a street performer. That was what first brought me.
You kind of have that character, you know, with the hat.
With the, yeah,
yeah.
I got the fedora. And
yeah,
when I first, but I was actually doing more juggling on the street than magic, because it actually is a lot more effective as far as building a crowd and maintaining a crowd, because it's much more visual.
Sure.
So if you can do a lot of comedic juggling, that works extremely well in those types of situations. But I've also been a tour guide in the French Quarter.
Cool.
And I would do, it's 2-hour tours, walking around the quarter, showing mm-hmm. people different things, the haunted history and things like that. And that, I think, is what really honed my street performing skills, because you never know what's going to happen. And there's hecklers at every corner, because every drunk idiot walking by sees a tour group and wants to say something, or, you know, just make an idiot of themselves.
Sure.
So they'll walk by and, like, someone goes, no matter what you're talking about, they'll go, like, he's lying. And it's kind of stock lines. You know, as a magician, you always hear, can you make my wife disappear? And you're hearing the same lines over and over.
Yeah.
As a tour guide, you hear these same things over and over, like, he's lying. So then you respond, like, read a book, you know, like, because you're talking about history.
Yeah.
So things like that would happen, and you just handle these situations. And people find it hilarious, because anytime they're engaged and they feel like they're experiencing a moment that's truly for them, because it's a total improv,
right.
They love it. And it's so much more effective than a practiced routine. And a lot of times we try to achieve that on stage. We want
right.
to create that feeling like this is happening just for you, one time only. This is a special show because of these situations.
Right.
And it teaches you how to handle pretty much any situation. At Winter Carnival, a lot of those guys had no idea who I was, because just except for last year, nobody really knew me in the magic world. And the table fell over in the middle of my act. And I'm doing my close-up act, and the table completely collapses. I wasn't even touching it. I don't know if it just was set up wrong. And because I just kept going with it, and I just made it funny, and I didn't let it affect me, I thought it was hilarious, actually. I was like, I can't believe this happened. I was glad it happened in front of magicians who can appreciate than, you know, a regular audience. And because I handled it well, I became a hero. They loved it. They loved that aspect of my act more than anything else, because they experienced this fun moment, and they saw how I handled it. And it was that kind of street training that I think gets you ready for that sort of thing.
Fumio Inagaki was at the TAOM many years ago in Abilene, and actually I remember this quite well because my wife was assisting him, and he'd won first prize for comedy, and the table fell over. And it wasn't, you know, it was over in the wings, it was to the side, and he set something down, and he walked back over, and he was doing a comedy act. Other things were happening that were very funny, but when the table fell over, he just walked over and just kind of pulled the curtain, kind of like, you didn't see that. You know, without saying anything, just kind of pulled it. That, and those kinds of things happened throughout. I remember Howard Hale just laughing his butt off, just thinking that was a fun, and so many people, you know, so, yeah, I think if you kind of go with it, because a lot of times that'll happen in a magician's life, particularly if they're young magicians who listen to this, you might be thinking that, well, if I drop something, that the audience saw that. Well, don't make a big deal. I mean, it's not the end of the world. I think it's still going to continue to spin on its axis. And so if you drop a thumb tip or something, you know, don't worry about it. Pick it up, kick it over, you know.
They don't know what's supposed to happen.
Exactly.
So.
And if something falls over, make a joke about it. You'll worry about it later. If something's broken, you know, don't stop the show and blame somebody else. You know, just keep the mood light. And so that way that they'll remember you a lot longer than too. What were some of the experiences you've had, like, on the street? That was, you know, interesting, you know, people yell out at you. But when you're doing something, I mean, in New Orleans, of all places, I mean, that's like where street, you know, people are king, you know. I mean, so tell me a couple of interesting...
Well, and you learn how to project, because you never know when a fire truck's going to come right by in the middle of your story blaring. And, wow, the number of things that have happened, I really need to make a list, because, I mean, it's just been crazy scenarios. One thing that happened that is an unbelievable story to me, I stopped the group right by this parking meter, and I leaned on the parking meter, and the whole thing just collapsed.
The
parking meter just like
fell
it,
right
just,
out of the
it just yeah just, well the thing fell off the pole like I realized it was wobbly, and when I touched it, it basically just came off in my hands just like butter, and I realized this is not normal, and the group is looking at me like, what are you doing? Because they don't, and I say, oh, we have portable meters, so if you don't have change, you bring it into this, and I'm just, you know, making stuff up. And then I said, I don't know how this happened, but I already have a feud with the parking people in New Orleans. I have already own a parking booth that's mine. I kept, and this is now mine, because as soon as I'm done with the tour, I'm going to come back and get this. Well, I had no idea what had happened to the thing. I bring it home, and that very same night, it was around Halloween time, and my buddy makes these big, he does demolition derbies, and we had cut the top off a school bus to make this like Halloween machine where we just go drive around on the quarter, throw beads at people, and he had like disco lights in there and sound system and probably a stripper pole. So he picks me up on this thing. I get work my way out of the back of the bus, and one guy is keeled over. One of his friends is just keeled over, and I said, really? It's kind of early. You're that wasted? He said, no, man. I'm feeling horrible. I was running to catch the bus, and Ronnie wouldn't stop, and I this guy was standing in the sidewalk, and I said, move, and he moved, and I ran right into a parking meter. I said, really? I said, was that by Plus Arms Hotel? He goes, how do you know that? I said, stop the bus, because we had made a circle by my house. I went and grabbed the meter, held it up like, walked on the bus like a victory, like, I got you, man. Yeah. And he's like, he's so confused. And I looked at him and I said, because, I mean, who knew that one of my friends was the reason that this parking meter was broken? And I said, listen, you need to get checked out, because a human body is not supposed to dislodge a parking meter.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, he was already keeled over. And so, sure enough, Halloween night, it's like 4 a.m., and this guy comes hobbling by the bottom of my steps, and he looks up and he goes, hey, Magic Mike, you were right, bruh. I went to the doctor. I got two broken ribs. I messed up my knee, and I got to wear a neck brace. All because he slammed into a parking meter. And I still have that parking meter. So, you know, that's the kind of crazy things that happen on tours. And just in New Orleans in general, it's a very magical city. And there's a lot of serendipity that goes on that you just don't expect or experience in other places. So it helps a lot with the creative process, I think, because it really gets your juices going when crazy stuff like that happens. You know, it's like, how can we create more of those moments when we're performing?
Yeah. Well, I wish you luck with FISM next year. That sounds like it's going to be great. As we start to wrap up, the name of the podcast is called The Magic Word. So what is your magic word?
That was the part we went over at 4F, because I said the one word, relentless.
Relentless.
I've adopted that word from a buddy of mine named Nathan Hanks. He used to put on, every time he turned on his phone, he would say that. And it's because in sales and marketing, it was his favorite word, relentless. And I feel like I've had to kind of adapt. I'm stealing his magic word, because he's not a magician.
Yeah.
Because that's how I feel like I've gone, when I've decided to go after things, whether it's magic competitions or just anything in my profession, to get it done, you got to be relentless about it.
Right.
And in practice and in preparation and everything.
That's a really good word. Yeah, I think you have to be. You can't just give up on your goal or your dream or whatever it is. You got to be relentless and go after it. Great. Thank you very much.
That was
Michael Darnon.
Thank you.
For the magic word, this is Scotty out. And so now we are here with Michael Bentz. Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks very much. And I wanted just to talk with you today because you just happened to be, walking by. It was interesting. We just finished a podcast over here and talking with Michael Darnon. And now we get to have a chat then with another Mike. Well, we're talking on a mic. So this, and you're going to be on the
There's
mic.
There's a lot
show.
Of mics on this show.
You're going to be on the mic show tonight. Now, tell me about the mic show tonight. I understand the concept. Everyone is mic, but what's going on?
It's, I don't know, it's still sort of a mystery to me why they chose everything. And I'm not sure if we're supposed to strip at the end of the show. That hasn't been asked yet, because it is the Magic Mike Show.
I'm
hoping people aren't disappointed, because they will be disappointed.
With some of the mics?
The case. Yeah, definitely.
Well, there's Big Mike, there's Little Mike, and who's that? Mrs. Mike?
Yeah. So I'm hope they don't have their expectations up.
Too high.
Yes.
And I thought it was funny, even Mike Michaels is going to be on. I mean, you can't have
Mike.
Enough Mike.
Right.
Now, you were on the cover of Magic Magazine, the February issue, as I recall.
Last June, yeah.
Okay, boy, time flies.
Yeah.
And a great piece. I'm sure you had to be flattered to on that. You've been working and doing kids shows. You just finished a kids show workshop here this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Good turnout. This was the first of the big three events here today. So tell me about it. Kind of what were you doing?
It was good. I was doing sort of bits and pieces. So some stuff from like library shows, like educational routines, mixed in with just some, birthday party routines and family show routines and a little bit of everything. So.
Yeah.
Yes, so it's not it's not like my regular show. It's just like,
was it more of a lecture or was it more
well,
of a workshop?
I did it. They actually brought in kids from the Boys and Girls Club.
Oh, nice!
So I did the show.
They'll be doing that each day.
Yep.
Oh.
So I did the show for the kids, and the kids were great. And then I talked about the show afterwards with the magician. So, which is a really good format. I hate doing a kid show lecture. I mean, kid show routines when there's no kids.
Yeah.
Because you have to keep saying, at this point, the kids are dying, and everyone's looking at you like, what? But, it's because there's no kids there,
That is difficult. It's like, okay, pretend like that you're a 7-year-old.
That just doesn't work.
About, I've never attended Kadabra, and I guess you're a strong proponent and been involved with that
I've been there.
And so do they have... Those are mostly kid show entertainers, obviously, but do they bring in children similar to what they've done here or not?
Yeah, they try to do that as much as possible. It's hard, in the evening shows, they're more geared just to the adults, So it's like any other convention show, but the lectures and things, they try to bring in kids of the right age. Somebody might do like a daycare lecture, so they bring in like a daycare.
Right.
Somebody might be doing like last year I did a library lecture, and they brought in, you know, kids, and I think I had maybe like 75 kids there, and it was great. So it's great, because you really have to see it in action.
Yeah.
Because it's a whole different animal, you know, like.
Yeah. Then again, trying to make somebody pretend like they're a kid or like that then as well. Now, I think when we may have first met, that you were, it was in Boston, Tuesday Night Magic. Way back when. And John Stetson and Steve Mystery
Lounge.
And Mystery Lounge and all that. Yeah. I still got one of the posters from the Green Street,
Green Street Grill. That's where we started out.
Now, do they still do that?
I think this is year 17 or something.
Whole
thing.
Yeah.
We switched from the Green Street Grill to the Mystery Lounge, which is inside a comedy club.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's,
is that like upstairs? I think I
went
to that later.
They were dark on Tuesday nights, and I suggested that we move the show over there Tuesday nights, and it's been going great. I mean, we used to take the summers off because we had small crowds, and it's been packed every week of the summer. And it's funny because when we advertised and we're getting press, no one was coming to the show. And now that we don't do anything, it's practically sold
it's
out.
It's kind of like an underground
week.
Thing. It's like, this is the place to go.
I think now, like, the concierges mention it, and the cab drivers mention it, and that's what you want. Come in from other countries, and they just, like, show up at our thing on Tuesday night, and it's just weird. I mean, it's just
it's
how
near
they
the college
find
campus,
it.
Too, as I recall.
It's right across the
right?
street from Harvard, And also... we tend to get a lot of MIT students who are incredibly easy to fool.
I was just about to ask you that question.
It is like the smarter they are, the easier they are to fool.
That's why your job is so difficult as a children's magician, because the kids are harder to fool.
Kids are much more difficult to fool.
They haven't been trained about misdirection, you know, or whatever.
And they're not polite about it, you know? I mean,
it's in your other hand. Of course it is.
A lot of magic for adults, the audience is being polite. They know how it was done, but they just applaud politely. You know, and kids will never do that. They will call you out every single time. But the problem with the kid calling you out is they could say you're doing the zombie ball or something. They say this is a thread, and as long as they say it, it's true.
Yeah.
You can do anything to prove there's not a thread, but once a kid says it, they're made up their mind.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah,
that is fact now. Okay, we can move on.
It is fact, right, yeah.
Well, go back to Harvard people and working with those. You said, like, the MIT, it seems like the smarter they are. Like, when I've worked with Mensa people, you know, done a mentalism show. You know, I was asked to do a mentalist show for Mensa, and I thought, that's going to be tough. My gosh, they were like buttered, you know.
And they think the technology is much more advanced.
And you're using it.
Yeah, and they're very, they kind of suggest all these cutting edge methods that, like, I haven't even heard of. And it's like, no, it's just a thumb tip. it's just a trick that's 200 years old. Yeah. You know, it's like, and it fools them, which is great.
Then you probably try to hit them with some sort of a strange joke or something, you know, what they're really not expecting. Of course, that's what the surprise is all about with magic, but I would think that with your personality and different ideas that you've got, I would think that they are kind of going down the road, but you come at them at a completely different angle, you know, from outside.
Yeah, well, I play up the fellow geek angle, you know, and that works out pretty well.
So
it's sort of like, I'll make certain references that, like, they'll get, and they'll go, oh, he's one of us, which is good.
So you don't attend many conventions. I don't see you very often. I go to quite a few, but
I
don't see you working.
I didn't, when my daughter was growing up, I didn't like to travel very much. Mm-hmm. So now that she's in college, now I'm kind of, like, getting out there and trying to do more conventions. And actually, when they did the Magic Magazine article, Rory said, my goal is to get you at conventions. And I'm like, okay, great. That's why we're doing this article, so that you're out there more, which is, like, great. So now I'm doing the monthly column for Magic.
Right.
Which has been going really well. Mm-hmm. And
clever ideas.
Thanks.
Lots of good things. I like that. You know, I'm not a children's entertainer, but the kinds of things, like when Silly Billy was writing the column, you know, he had a lot of people who were writing, and it's just, although I'm not going to do it, I just like the creative thought and your and the writing style, his and yours, you know, so I do enjoy that.
And also, like, when I Stan had talked to me about doing the column like a long, long time ago, and it sort of took like 4 or 5 years to finally
twist your arm far enough.
Well, no, it was more like to find the right timing of what to do with it. And he had seen me at a few different things and a few different conventions, and he said, I don't want it to be just kid show. He said, I was trying to, like, I don't want you to get pigeonholed, because you do stand-up, you do this, you do this.
Sure, yeah, you do.
And he said, so at first I was thinking it was going to be a kid show thing and family, and he said, I just decided that it should just be whatever you want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
So some weeks some months it's a stand-up routine, some months it's a kid show routine, some months it's an essay, you know. So it's sort of like, I work much better under that environment of like, just do whatever you want
to
do.
Whatever you want,
And it seems to be working out pretty well.
Right.
But I had a routine for the Daring Spring Trap.
Yes.
In there that you would never do for a kid show. And, you know, so it's, you know, a little bit of everything. So,
yeah. Right. And you're going to be at the Magic Magazine, Magic Live, next month, I guess?
Yep, I'm going to be attending that. Yeah.
And are you going to be lecturing, performing, anything in that?
I am not allowed to divulge anything on the grounds that may incriminate me.
Well, I'm going to be there with my podcast then again. So.
Great.
Yeah. And so what are your plans long-term from here, aside from after tonight? I mean, what are you doing day to day? What are you doing for dinner? No. What's our Mike Bentz plan?
It's funny. The last few years, I've put out a lot of products. I haven't been putting stuff out just because I've been too busy.
Yeah.
And it takes
a
lot of...
Yeah, a few things on your website.
Yeah.
And by the way, your book is fantastic.
Thank you.
Was it TAOM a couple years ago? I think it's when I got that from you.
Yeah, the Everything Guide to Comedy Writing. Yeah.
I highly recommend that book.
Yeah. I think it's funny because the three, like, best-selling three of the best-selling books on comedy have been written by magicians. It's Judy Carter wrote
Judy Carter's
a stand-up
got a
book. My book and Jay Sankey's book.
Yep, so I got all
and
three.
I think it's really interesting that it's like three magicians are like in that, you know, the best-selling magic books. I mean, comedy books. It's kind of like, and it's funny. In my lecture, I talk about how if you look at some of the dominant names of comedy in the 20th century, you have Harold Lloyd, you have Johnny Carson, you have.
Milton Berle, Seed Caesar,
Woody Allen. They're all magicians.
Seed Martin.
Steve Martin, a magician. Like the guys that really like benchmark people that changed everything.
Yeah.
Those were all magicians. And I think there's something about the way we think mixed with comedy that is I think it's closer than most people think, I think.
Yeah.
The process. And I just find it interesting that, like, some of the best names of the 20th century were all magicians, you know, and comedians.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And so you are developing some more products.
Yes, more products. And like, to do more conventions and that kind of thing. And,
okay.
Yeah.
And get your daughter out of college.
Yes, she's got two more years left. And,
she's not going to MIT, I guess.
No, she's going to American University in Washington.
Great. That's great. Yeah. Well, Mike, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So my question to you is, I ask all my guests of what is your magic word? It's not, you know, like abracadabra necessarily, but, you know, what is your mantra? What is your slogan?
My slogan is, it's funny because every magician in England has a magic word. You know, that's like wibbly wobbly, is Terry Herbert, you know, and it's like they all have this thing, and it's kind of a thing. And I've never really done that. But my mantra is... You know how Thurston supposedly used to say, I love my audience.
Right.
What I say before the show is, I need to find some way to make it better. I just need to find one little thing to make it better. And the whole show, I'm hunting for that one little, like a little nuance. I change a look. I hold the prop up higher. Just some little thing to make it better. And then I think if your brain is always looking for something better, you'll find it.
How can I, during the presentation, the performance you're about to do?
Yeah.
I mean, you've already done that a bunch of times. You know what you're going to be doing, but you're trying to...
I'm just always thinking of a way to make something better.
What little thing?
Just to find one thing per show.
I like
it just makes it... It doesn't have to be huge.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's huge, but sometimes it's just a little thing.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it keeps me motivated during the show.
Sure.
And especially when you're doing lots of shows. And it... I think it's a good way to, if you ask your brain the right questions, it'll give you the right answers.
I like that.
Yeah, so.
That's true. And you got a very creative mind.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Okay,
thanks.
That's Mike Bentz for The Magic Word. And from the floor of the IBM Convention Phoenix, Scotty out.
Well, we are on day two of the convention still, and the stage contest has ended. And I thought it was kind of interesting that I think you guys will enjoy getting to hear from someone who has seen a lot of contests over the years because he's been so intimately involved with the World Magic Summit. It used to be the World Magic Seminar and then the World Summit, I think, from Mitch Block, you know, kind of combined with Joe Stevens and all that. So let me just jump in here and say, here's Nick St. Ern. Hey, Nick, how are you?
Hello, Scott. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
I wanted to have you on there because my son's name's Nicholas, and so I love the name Nick, so I want to have a guy named Nick. You got here just in the nick of time. So I wanted to ask you about just from your experience, you've been to how many, all of the World Magic Summits?
Yeah, so I was at every World Magic Seminar from when it started as the Magic in the Desert, then the Desert Magic Seminar, and then the World Magic Seminar. So I attended all of those. There'd be 34 of those over the years, mm-hmm. and then about 18 years ago, we started the teen contest, mm-hmm. and so I've been the director of the teen contest at the World Magic Seminar since its inception.
And are you from Wichita originally?
From Wichita originally.
Okay.
Grew up with Joe Stevens, worked in his magic shop for many years, and
right.
then after I graduated from college, I moved to Las Vegas so I get closer to the heart of magic.
And you actually served then helping other magicians with their animals?
Yes. So I am a veterinarian by profession, but I also have been doing magic since I was in first grade. And so as a magician and a veterinarian, I got to help a lot of magicians in Las Vegas. At one time, I had about 40, 50 different magicians as my clients mm-hmm. at the veterinary clinic. And so they'd come in with lions and tigers and birds and dogs, all different animals, pigs. Anything that they were using in their show, I was able to help them take care of. And I also got to help them routine their magic because knowing the magic side of it and the animal side, I helped a lot of the magicians work animals into their act.
Now, David Oliver has had the disease that was caused by dove dust, I guess, or something, and then he had to have a double lung transplant. Was that something that was unheard of or you were familiar with? Or
yeah, it's psittacosis. It's a bacterial infection, chlamydophila, and it's not very common, but if you do get it and don't get it treated, it can become very severe. It is a treatable disease with mm-hmm. antibiotics. Doxycycline will treat it. But unfortunately, a lot of doctors aren't familiar with it coming from birds, so they might think you have pneumonia or some other disease and don't get you the right treatment initially. So mm-hmm. then by the time they finally actually make the diagnosis, it can progress to become very serious.
What are some of the symptoms?
Exactly like the flu. Hmm. So it's coughing, wheezing, shortness of breath, fever, congestion, and many times if you were to have this disease, you would think you just had the flu. And, you know, maybe the flu would get over in a few days or a week, mm-hmm. But with this one, without antibiotics, it can progress and keep going. So unfortunately, if a person went to the doctor and they said, oh, you got the flu, and they didn't give you anything because the flu
right.
is a virus and there's
right.
no treatment, no antibiotics. But with psittacosis, you can put them on antibiotics, you'll clear up very quickly. Without antibiotics, most healthy adults could recover on their own, but if you had other immune disease or anything that was reducing your immunity, it can become very severe, and unfortunately, as what happened to David, had a very severe case of it.
Would he just have flu-like symptoms for a long period of time, and it just can't shake it? Or
yeah, and typically it could persist for weeks to months.
It might be like a walking pneumonia, even,
exactly.
is what people think they
yeah.
might have.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are a bird worker and you do have flu-like mm-hmm. symptoms, consider psittacosis, which is a bacterial infection from birds. Any type of bird can carry it. We see it a lot in parrots, but doves can also carry it. So if mm-hmm. you are a dove worker, you can also have your birds tested for it. It is an easy disease to test for, and mm-hmm. so if you took your birds to a veterinarian, the veterinarian could do a health check on them and do a test on them, make sure that your birds are healthy and not carrying the bacteria, and then that would reduce your risk.
Now, is that something that's passed from one bird to the other, I guess, in
yes.
the same coop, I guess, and
it,
whatnot?
It can be spread between birds. Birds can also develop resistance to it, not really an immunity, but they can get an infection, they can recover, and they can become a persistent carrier, which means they have the bacteria in their system. It's no longer making them sick, but mm-hmm. they could pass it on to other birds or even people that they come into contact with.
And then the worst thing can happen is obviously death, but if it's caught kind of towards the end of the of the period, kind of like with David Oliver, that you end up having to get your lungs replaced.
Yes, and that is a pretty extreme case. However, yeah. There have been people who have died from it. But usually the deaths are associated with either elderly people or people that already have other pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
A young, healthy adult would usually not die, but unfortunately, you know, and it can progress.
Now, are there other things, like, let's say, from rabbits, you know, or other livestock that magicians might use that they should look out for?
Yeah, less commonly, but it can occur. Rabbits can have some bacterial infections. Pasteurilosis is very common in rabbits, which is a bacterial disease that causes sneezing and snuffles, runny nose, and it is, again, treatable.
Like an allergy, basically?
Yeah, more like a runny nose, like a cold. And so they'll get discharge from the eyes, discharge from the nose, maybe some wheezing while they breathe. And that can be treated with antibiotics as well.
Mm-hmm.
So for any magician who's listening to this, if you do use animals in your act, make sure you take good care of them. And also make sure you get good veterinary care because, you know, they're your partners. They can perhaps be the key to your livelihood, so you want to make sure you take good care of them as well. And if you find a veterinarian that treats exotic pets or birds, you know, they can run routine tests, check them out, make sure they're healthy, and keep them healthy. The other thing that you need to be aware of is also nutrition because a lot of people don't understand the proper nutrition for pets, and you might think, well, I just give rabbits rabbit pellets and I just give birds some bird seed. But they actually have other nutritional needs, and you need to supplement their diet with vitamins, minerals, and maybe even some fresh greens. So for magicians that travel with their animals, that's a consideration they have to take is proper care of the pets while they're on the road and then also at home giving them the proper diet so that they can live long, healthy lives.
Just as you would your dog, cat, or any other type of animal, I guess, that you would have domestically?
Exactly. I mean, a lot of us grew up, you know, maybe with a dog and you're feeding it table scraps and things like that. And what we've learned over the years is that proper nutrition can keep them healthier their entire life and have them live longer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not uncommon to Gary Darwin in Las Vegas had a dog that lived for 24 years. And so that's, you know, not real common, but it can happen. And with proper nutrition and proper veterinary care, your pets can live a lot longer.
And as you said, that's your livelihood also, that you're going to be using doves and rabbits, that you need to take care of them. And there are some people, of course, in Vegas and other places that are using the larger animals, wild animals, I guess, and they have a whole set of other types of issues, but I would think that the larger the animal, the more you would want to try to take care of it, but they probably should all be treated the same.
Yeah, they should. One of the things to consider is the larger animals usually come with a bigger expense.
Yeah.
And they're expensive to feed, mm-hmm. they're expensive to care for, so you have to take that into consideration. So just thinking, well, there's a lot of magicians that use a big cat in the act, I'm going to get one to do that. If you don't plan ahead and realize the thousands of dollars it may take just to feed it,
yeah.
You may not be earning enough money to actually care for the cat.
Right, right. It seems like I've heard stories about that from time to time, you know, where they haven't, they've had some big animals, but they have not been kept well because they can't afford to do the shows.
Right.
As a result, that the animals have to go to some home or they get destroyed.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's a situation we don't want to happen. We don't want magicians to ever get bad publicity, especially for not taking care of
them. What about monkeys? I mean, I don't see magicians ever use monkeys, but I think that'd be
goodness.
Kind of... But monkeys are funny, you know.
Yeah. When I was in practice in Las Vegas, I did actually take care of a number of show monkeys, and they are dangerous, they're messy,
mm-hmm.
and they actually carry a lot more diseases that humans can catch
wow.
than other types of animals because they're
mm-hmm.
so closely related.
Yeah.
So there are a number of viruses in monkeys that can kill you.
Wow.
So think twice before getting a monkey.
Unless it's a mechanical one. Yeah.
Those are the best,
yeah.
especially if you can routine the clapping the cymbals into your show.
There you go. That's an easy one. Well, let's go back again to the World Magic Seminar. That, as I recall, the first one wasn't Wichita. That's why I was asking. I knew that you worked with Joe and that he had kind of a little workshop or something. I remember David Copperfield had come, and that first
right.
one, that would have been about
1980.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we did have the Mid-America Magic Conclave, and we had a
yeah.
little thing going on in Wichita. And so one year we decided to bring all the Las Vegas close-up performers to Wichita mm-hmm. for the convention. And it was a great convention. And Jay Marshall told Joe, he said, this is great, but wouldn't it be better for all of us to go to Las Vegas and see these guys
yeah.
instead of trying to bring them to Wichita?
Yeah.
And so that sparked the idea for starting the Magic Convention in Las Vegas. And
mm-hmm.
it grew to be one of the biggest magic conventions and was a great, great event in Magic.
It was so much fun, and you really kind of got to know these guys on a more of a personal basis. You know, one I remember is going to Siegfried and Roy's home.
Twice during the conventions, we actually had tours of their home and got to see the animals and see where they take care of them. So you don't get that opportunity very often.
That was a lifetime experience. That was just something that was kind of incredible.
And going backstage when they're just opened their new show at
the Mirage,
we all got to go backstage to the theater and see the workings behind it. We got to go see Lance Burton when he was at the at the Tropicana, and then he had his own show at the Hacienda, and then later at the Monte Carlo. So the convention became part of getting to go see all those other shows as well, and then a lot of performers that were in Las Vegas at the time became part of the convention, and the convention got to become involved in their shows.
Right. And then you have been doing Magic, as you said, for a long time as well, in addition to being a veterinarian. Do you still do shows occasionally?
I do. So I never intended to become a magician. It actually started when I was in first grade, and I got a My Favorite Martian magic kit from my sister for Christmas, which then I became interested in magic, did magic all through grade school. I joined the International Brotherhood of Magicians in 1974. So this is my 40th year of being a member of the International Brotherhood of Magicians. And through that, I was able to meet lots of other magicians, found out that, you know, there were many more people like me as a kid growing up. And so then I ended up getting the opportunity to work for Joe Stevens with his magic shop and then also at the magic convention. So magic was something that just became part of my life. But I always, from when I was very little, wanted to become a veterinarian and decided to pursue that as a career. So at least I'd have a steady income.
Right.
And it's worked out really well. I'm actually at the top of the field in veterinary medicine. I'm leaving tomorrow to do 5 days of speaking at the American Veterinary Medical Association convention in Chicago. And I just came back from doing a 2-day seminar in Hawaii, where I spent 5 days in Hawaii so I could do 2 days of lecturing.
Yeah.
So that was a good trip. They paid me and paid my expenses on all these things. And so as a veterinarian, I've done really well. And I actually attribute a lot of that to my growing up being a magician, because it gave me that public speaking skill. I can stand up in front of an audience of people and talk to them and feel very comfortable doing it. So I have to say, in many ways, magic has helped my career as a veterinarian. And then, of course, being in Las Vegas as a veterinarian and the magicians coming as my clients, in my waiting room, I had the 8x10 glossy photos of all the magicians in Vegas that were coming into my clinic, and they'd all, you know, sign it to Dr. Nick, thanks for taking care of my animals. So that's good PR, you know, when your clients come in and see that. magic's been very, very good to me.
And so your advice to juniors is to, first of all, follow your passion, if you have one, into whatever business world that you want to get into, with magic kind of as a backup, as opposed to the other way around. Some people think, well, I'm going to be a magician, but I'll be a car mechanic as a backup or something.
Yeah, well, if you're saying
the other way around.
If you can be a car mechanic and do magic with the car parts and then amaze your clients, and you're going to build a reputation and you'll get people coming back to your shop just to see you. So I found that worked for me. And you know, my wife jokes that when we retire, we'll be able to, you know, put an act together and travel the world doing cruise ships. So magic is something that I still do, and I can always continue doing. And so it's a great thing to be involved with that will last your entire life.
That's great. Well, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And so to start to wrap up, what would be your magic word or mantra, your slogan, your what do you live by, your philosophy?
Wow. Okay.
Could be a word or phrase.
Yeah, that's a tough one to think about. I tell you, part of it is just really find what you're passionate in, what you really like to do. Because if it's something that you have to do every day and you don't like doing it, that's going to be a very miserable existence. So you really need to find what you're passionate about and then find a way to do it. So I'll give you just one quick example. As wanting to be a veterinarian, I also, in addition to liking magic, liked fish. And so I started keeping fish when I was 9 years old, and I decided very early on that it would be great to be a veterinarian for fish.
Okay.
And that's something most people would say, what in the world are you thinking, right? So I pursued veterinary medicine. I actually got a degree in fisheries biology before going into veterinary medicine, and I worked as a private practitioner for 15 years and was able to start working through pet shops and getting involved with the pet industry. And so for the last 15 years, I have been the veterinarian at PetSmart Corporation, which is based here in Phoenix, Arizona, and I am now in charge of the fish business of the health of the fish at PetSmart, and it's a multi-million dollar section of the business, and we sell 30 million fish a year.
Holy cow.
And so I'm in charge of the health care for all the fish in all the 1,300 stores and 5 distribution centers around the U.S. and Canada. Yeah. And so I am a full-time fish veterinarian and making a really good living doing that.
So doing what you originally started having as a dream.
Which 30 years ago, who would have thought there's such a thing as a fish veterinarian?
Magician.
And a magician. So you have to have magic in order to do this.
So follow your passion.
Exactly.
Otherwise it becomes work.
And right.
It's not fun.
You don't want to have to work your entire life. You want to have fun.
Fun. That's right. That's great. Nick, thank you very much.
I appreciate your time. Thank you, Scott.
Here.
It was wonderful.
All right. And so from the convention floor again over here at the Magic Word Podcast, Scotty out.